all of the accidents and converts them into a solid order that is experienced as necessary, right?
Yeah, and it gives, you know, on a kind of existential level, one could say it gives a sort of, you know, reason for being, as you use like the, you know, the Heideggerian term, which Bong Chul-Han also uses, this kind of being at home. You know, you're not only are you being in the world, but now when you're being at home, when you live in a narrative society, or a society imbued with a particular kind of narrative story or whatever you're living in that. And it's important to say that one of the key factors of the narrative story of being in a narrative-based society is essentially not being aware of the narrative, instead of like, and that's kind of like the point of like being at home, instead of it being a subject of scrutiny or study, the point is that you are living it out. Like you are actually a participant in this greater story, right? You are a member, one could say, or a character in this novel that is your society, culture, place, time, whatever it's going to be, right? And you know, and being at home, obviously the term, one can kind of think it out, tease it out a little bit, but, you know, without getting too into the Heideggerian side, like obviously the home element is a comfortability, right? One can knows how to operate in that world, is comfortable there, has a position, lives that out, and it isn't something of like reflective scrutiny. You just kind of, you know, in a very like kind of existential Heideggerian sense, you know, it is a practice that happens, right? It's a style of life, a form of life.
Yeah, essentially the conditions don't exist to doubt it. They don't exist to be unfamiliar or to be shocked by it, right? I mean, like, home is precisely the place where you don't have to check whether the doors work, you know, or what's around the corner. Home is precisely where that doubt doesn't exist, right? One of the ways that this kind of manifests in modernity is this call to home or something like that, right? Where we want to go back or whatever, kind of the nostalgia that finds itself expressed as a kind of malaise of modernity, Charles Taylor might put it. But the interesting thing about this is that there is another side, not necessarily a side, but Byung Chul-Han puts in as a counterforce to narration, information, right? Which narration is the capturing and expression of a fact, which is by definition contingent, right? So you might live in a narratological world, and it might turn out that there is some information, like if I'm a shepherd, I have this many sheep, right? That's information. But this information doesn't really existentially govern me, right? This information is couched within a world I don't have to necessarily rely on the form of information. I don't need to, how do I put this? My world is not structured by contingency, by waiting for the next shoe to drop, right? It's difficult to imagine what a world structured by just handed down information would look like, but this is precisely the world that Byung Chul-Han is trying to describe. And because we're in this world, again, we find ourselves in the midst of it, and just as much as a narrativized subject has difficulty seeing the sort of structure of their world such that they could doubt it, it's quite difficult to see the fact that, you know, we are constantly being bombarded by information.
I think that there's two immediate aspects of the information world that John brings up that are very clear. One is, you know, information is constantly open to revision. The way that you understand that and the way that looks like a directional structure, whereas the information age, everything becomes contingent because everything is now sort of open to analyzation, which means it's open to revision, which means things can change, you know, instantly. And this is, you know, one of the benefits, obviously, of you know, the kind of scientific revolution and that sort of perspective taking hold. But it does also induce a kind of social anxiety, right? That, like, you know, as you're saying, it's actually with contingency, like, we understand things to be this way, but like that understanding, that knowledge, that information might change on a dime. It might have a radical shift in a new direction. And that's obviously very anxiety inducing. The other aspect of it too is that this information no longer coheres in a story. It just becomes effectively like individual monads of information, of stuff, right? And especially for the average individual living out in this world, basically what you end up with is this term that would come up a lot in the philosophy of media that media theory, which is fragmentation, right? You basically have all sorts of information about everything, but it's not connected in any sort of coherent story or web. It's just sort of like a chaotic mess or storm of stuff coming at you, of just facts, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think fragmentation also plays a role in not just fragmentation as far as, okay, well, you're getting this notification, you're getting this update, you're seeing this on the news. That is absolutely fragmentation. But fragmentation is at least more broadly and probably more consequentially. Fragmentation is not just the sort of scattershot of information that we're getting, but it's the rupture of the necessity felt by the narrative itself, right? Byung-Chan says, once narratives are seen as something constructed, they lose their moment of inner truth. That is, they lose their feeling of necessity, right? What was interesting about narratives was when they ordered accidents into necessary kind of stages and they ordered those into a meaningful narrative, the narrative itself gained a kind of necessity, right? Because it gained the same kind of shaking, the unshakable binding force that the narrative is meant to explain, right? But once we come upon seeing that this narrative itself is just one among many narratives and we start questioning meta-narratives in a sort of postmodern inquiry, we start to see that, you know, actually these narratives themselves are things that we can pick up and put down. They are just as exchangeable as other information, right? So we can kind of pick and choose our narratives. But once we do that, the narrative itself has lost its magic, has lost its inner moment of truth. And that is one of the other aspects of the fragmentation is no longer do we, not only have we sort of given ourselves all kinds of options for whatever narrative we might pick, but the very fact of doing so means that we've kind of blown it for all of the narratives, right? Because now they have lost their necessity and they're all contingent. They're all just information, and all of the contexts within which this information had any ordering no longer have the same necessity that would have given those contingent facts the order they need to become the accidents that fall into a necessary order, right? So it's not, fragmentation is not just the bombardment of information, but it's the exploding of any kind of framework at all that would give these facts any semblance of meaning.
You know, like the obvious person to think about a little bit with this sort of, you know, exactly what you're talking about, this explosion of like the fundamental social narratives, I immediately go to or think about Nietzsche, right? And I'm not going to sit here and pretend I'm going to like quote a specific line. But, you know, when Nietzsche obviously and many times talks about like, you know, the death of God or living through an era when you sort of see the disintegration of the authority of religion within society. And then the obvious question that Nietzsche poses in one way or another is, you know, okay, like, well, what's going to come next, right? If religion is no longer this sort of like binding force, we no longer have this big binding story that sort of makes sense of everything. Now we're sort of left in this sort of like hollow space of anxiety, and he's got a bunch of answers for where that'll go or who's going to, you know, what kind of person is going to take the lead. But it seems like, I think what Byung-Chul Han would say is, instead of something really replacing that structure, as you're sort of saying, the structure just kind of blows up, right? Instead of being like, oh, you know, and then, you know, the Ubermensch steps in and guides, you know, whatever, like, and of the values, and yeah, exactly, and builds a whole new structure. Instead, what we find is, like, the structuring system itself just becomes this, like, it kind of, like, the like remains in chaos effectively.
Yeah, it remains in chaos. It remains fragmented. No particular tradition has the capacity to replace any other, because once the gig is up for one of them, you've sold the, you know, you've sold it for all of them. You can't just pretend like you can slot in one meta narrative when you were critiquing meta narratives per se, right? Like, that wouldn't make sense.
But I think, and getting into like today's talking about conspiracy theories, I think the important point, and Byung-Chul Han would note this, is people do try. And you get these sort of like, what ends up happening too is you get these sort of almost smaller, one could almost see them as like the religion falls apart and is replaced by many cults, cultic narrative type situations, which is obviously kind of hinting into getting to things like conspiracy theories and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense why conspiracy theories sort of have taken the place that they have, right? And I think it goes to show the assessment, or at least the framework that Byung-Chul Han is working within, is like an intelligible way to analyze and to try to understand the situation. Because if you look at what conspiracy theories are trying to do, what they're trying to do is they're trying to take disparate information, just like random things that people see or notice or want to try to explain, and they're trying to order them, right? I mean, conspiracy theories are trying to fit the bill for what narratives previously did. And the fact that Byung-Chul Han is sort of making these two commensurate in a way gives us a way of addressing conspiracy theories, but it also goes to show that, like, oh, actually, yes, the explosion of, you know, previous meta narratives really does take this form of the disordering of information, right? So if you think of, I mean, I can't think of like a particular conspiracy theory off the top of my head, but we can, it's very easy to imagine that in any given conspiracy theory, one's belief in it is not really predicated upon like the, or I should say, like their belief in it is predicated upon like the overall system, because it kind of works like a coherent system, things like mutually holding each other up. But it's more or less initially like bought into, we should say, like the buy-in to this.
I think buy-in is the yeah, important one.
Yeah, the buy-in here is like there are certain things that are happening, like there's certain facts, and there's like no sense to what's happening, right? And you start to notice what, you know, what they call patterns, right? If you want to like really push someone into a conspiracy theory, all you have to do is line up the right facts in the right order. Put, if you get your ducks in a row, then you can sell the theory, right?
Yeah, I think like the buy-in is an incredibly important concept, because like basically, like you said earlier, like we Byung-Chul Han is largely talking, or at least opining about, you know, the era of meta-narratives, right? Like Christianity, as we kind of use, we're using frequently as an example, that's a meta-narrative, right? It was a overarching structure and system that obviously dissipated out into many different formations and societies, but it gave a generalized structure to like a very long breadth of time and place, which the people understood themselves to be in. The meta narratives are dead.
Okay, there's actually one thing that I wanted to touch on here, which I think really goes to show the how deep we are, or like I should say, this almost makes me think we're more screwed, is the fact that you really do find, of course, Christian believers, you find Muslims, you find people who are involved in all kinds of religions sincerely. You know, it's not like if we were to think, okay, we're in a post-meta-narrative world, that would still be a certain order, right? That is like the postmodern narrative. Not even that is true. Like, you really do find theists next to atheists. You find, you know, people involved in like neo-paganism with like genuinely old, like, you know, shamanic religions or something like that, like Shintoism. So it's not just that like, oh, it's exploded and none of this works. It's even more fragmented than that. It's so patchwork that it works for some people. It doesn't work for others, but like they find themselves bumping up against, everyone just finds themselves bumping up against each other. That's
what I was actually going to kind of say is exactly that, is instead of these meta narratives, what you end up what we've ended up in, or what, and I think conspiracy theories are a really good example of this, is we might even call micro narratives, right? And that's where the buy-in comes in, and why buy-in is so important, because these micro narratives, like, obviously, as Bung Chul Han will say, like, these, and he does bring up conspiracy theories in this formulation effectively, but basically they give a story for why things are the way they are, right? And you can buy into that story, or people, believers, buy into that story. And in buying in, you are committing to putting very significant blinders on, right? Like very, very significant, very intense at like times blinders. You know, I think about like current micro narratives that people have bought into, conspiracy theories. I think about like down in the States, obviously, unfortunately, with like the Trump movement and MAGA and all that kind of stuff, the election fraud narratives, right? Now, these are really interesting because I personally, when looking at them, have never encountered anything that looks like good evidence. And the evidence that I have encountered and shown is just like overtly bad. Or it's not even evidence. It's like someone just saying that they know something, but you know, we can't divulge. It's like the QAnon type stuff too. It's like, I can't say too much, but like, yeah, like, but it's interesting. It's like, but then there's like obvious counterpoints to that, like to the fact that in 2016, Trump, I remember listening right before the first election with him. I remember listening to him on the radio and someone asked him, would you accept the election if you lose? And his response was, no, I will not accept losing an election. So right there, right at the beginning of everything, he's already saying, if I'm ever in a position of loss, I will pretend, I will say that I didn't lose. Like it's, but the point is to that is like the for individuals that kind of believe this conspiracy and all this kind of stuff, the buy-in is so intense. And it's so intense because it gives people, it's comforting. Basically, it's the long short of it is it sort of re-imbues at least a small local group with a kind of narrative concern that they can now, they're part of, you know, now they're a member of this story, of this crisis, of this situation, and you know, and there's evil forces and there's good forces and blah 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 blah, and you start to see again what looks like a narrative start to form, and giving up that narrative is exceptionally difficult, right? Just in the same way that giving up religious narratives or whatever it's going to be is exceptionally difficult too, because it becomes a really essential part of someone's identity, and how, not just identity, but as we've said before, being at home, right? Of a world that they feel like they understand.
Yeah. I mean, it is the condition for the structure of order and meaning in any kind of, like, we should say, in terms of like, you know, the election fraud conspiracy, it's interesting how, because you could easily bracket it, be like, okay, well, that makes political sense. It just organizes like what's going on in the political sphere. But it's really interesting, especially considering how for Americans, politics is like, a lot of politics just is culture, especially like at this point. That really bleeds down quite far, because now it organizes like how you speak to people, or who you relate to, or like what services you can use or whatnot, right? Like, so it structures your world in such a radical way that if it seems like it's something that people go to for comfort, it's not so much that they're looking to like just ignore things or like run into a story. It's just that like, this is just what comfort and ease of living is, what having a life with sense looks like. There's an Archimedean point that's been structured, and if you took that away, that would be very destabilizing.
Conspiracy theories, they're micro-narratives because a lot of times, in most cases, conspiracy theories don't make a lot of sense. Like, they're not, like, but as you said, like, they have it become, especially within American culture and Western culture more generally, you are starting to see this, it's like this desperation for narrative is so strong that people are willing to jump on ships that like really don't make a lot of sense, or really don't correspond very well with the facts of the matter. And generally, like, these are also deeply emotional. Conspiracy theories in general have a lot more emotional content or emotional weight than factual content.
They organize what that factual content means, right? So it's one thing for, like, you know, kids to be starving and there to be like actual famine in America, but another to be like, okay, well, there's a reason for that, and it's because like the Democrats, they're evil, and you know, they are like trying to, they're coming after our kids, and you know, they want to do all these bad things and stuff like that. It gives a meaning to those facts.
Conspiracy theories have become such a big component of our social discourse and political discourse that they've become, that the irony is they become mainstream, which is very chaotic in a political and social sphere. Because you effectively have a new formation of what you would almost call the equivalent in older periods would be like a religious zealots entering the form of political discourse, entering the political sphere, having topics and points of concerns and perspectives that are not actually there to respond to issues at hand, but are only there to support like belief in the system that they have committed to.
Yeah. There's almost like a kind of a social selectability for it. Like the internet has kind of made the world really big. Yeah, and you could talk to everyone, but you would just get so bogged down in all of this new information that here's this one thing you can do is you create a system whereby, like, if you use the talking points, you kind of signal you're in it. But if you don't, or you're, like, averse to them, well, then you don't really have to listen to these people. And it makes the world just big enough, right? Like, conspiracy theories, I like the term micro-narratives. Conspiracy theories are believed by, and they're effective because they give, like, a kind of communicability between large groups of people, right? So they give people a common ground to understand certain facts. And I think an important function of it is that it deselects certain people from being able to participate in that. And not just from a kind of like exclusionary point, but almost maybe from like, you know, this idea of like the monkey circle, like we can only hold like a certain amount of people's, like we can only like really register like 250 to like, or I think it's like 2000, a certain number of people, right? We can only hold so many people in our heads. If we had to genuinely like actually consider everyone that had a stake in this discussion, and we'd just go crazy. So we have to have some system for cutting off certain people, and maybe like a conspiracy theory is a way of, again, I use this phrase, making the world big enough.
Storytelling produces narratives in a consumable form. It charges products with emotion. It promises unique experiences. We buy, sell, and consume narratives. Emotion is story, sell, story, selling is storytelling. At the end of the day, we say micro-narratives. Conspiracies are more like stories than they are narratives because they're very condensed and they frequently don't actually involve a lot of like external information. They tend to be like very focused on like one particular thing and a particular set of actors. And they sort of like cordon off the possibilities of involvement in situations and outcomes from any other groups or actors, whoever it might be. But the flip side of that is there's a certain way in which engaging with conspiracy theories and engaging with these micro-narratives, engaging with these stories and this kind of thing, what it ends up doing is creating a larger conspiracy network because people, like, these sorts of things become jumpable, right? Like, even though they're not actually necessarily connected, the way of an individual and a group's formation of, like, a wider reality now becomes a patchwork of a bunch of different little conspiracies and stories that one can kind of consume and cycle through. And they don't actually, like, even though you can somehow believe all these different things or say you believe them all at the same time, they're either, like, not connected at all or contradict each other. But it's basically what I'm saying is it's still a way of being, a way of being in the world, which is not actually a narrative formation, right? It's not actually a solid story. It is a continuation of this shift into like more of a chaotic patchwork of just like stuff coming at you, which you're then trying to cohere into multiple little stories and narratives, all of which like don't necessarily connect with each other, but you believe and engage with all the stuff.
Well, I do have this kind of temptation to romanticize it and think that this is just something that Americans do when they're looking to organize meaning in sort of organize the information that they're getting. Again, this is not a narrative. These are not narratives. They're mutually contradictory. They interpret and sort of make salient facts that like don't even really matter, honestly. Like, do we really want to be organizing the way that we live around these particular facts? Are these really the exigencies around which we live our lives? I don't think they are. I think that there are more authentic experiences that we have around which we can rally some kind of narrative, one that's maybe more, if it doesn't work for everyone, at least works for more people. Ideally, it would work for everyone. That's kind of the dream, I suppose. But the point is that these are consumable, right? They're still being sold to people. People are still, in conspiracies, it's people being exploited. It's not just people being sold to, right? Conspiracy is not a fandom. I mean, a fandom you buy into almost like kind of consensually. And that's one maybe less harmless or less harmful way of consuming stories. But again, it's not the real thing. We should be continuing to figure out what that looks like and how we can get back to that, if at all. I mean, we didn't even get really into Byung-Chul Han's considerations of why this is happening, which is the modern conditions of mass media. And that might just be a Pandora's box we can't close. Well, in any case, I think that is a pessimistic enough note to end this show on. You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I've been Brandon, and joining me today has been Hale. Thank you for listening.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Hi there, this is Jan Arden, and if you're listening to something fabulous, well, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Simon Fraser University Radio, streaming on the internet at cjsf.ca.
This is broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. From Mexico to Mongolia, Sweden to South Africa,
many, many, many people across the globe are feeling the effects of extreme heat that is fueled by climate change.
Roop Singh is at the Red Cross Red Crescent Climate Center, which co-authored a report about global extreme heat from May 2024 to May 2025.
We found that 4 billion people, about 49% of the global population, experience at least 30 additional days of extreme heat due to human-caused climate change.
And in many areas of the tropics, people saw more than 100 additional days of extreme heat, that is, days that are hotter than 90% of the temperatures historically observed in the local area. Extreme heat can be deadly, but Singh says cities and countries can help protect residents, for example, by educating people on how to stay hydrated, increasing access to air conditioning, and developing early warning systems for heat waves.
This threat is here and now. It's not really a future problem. It will continue to get worse, but there are tons of actions that we can take to reduce the impacts.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
For 40 years, the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, aka SFPIRG, has been helping students build communities at SFU. Campus organizations like Out on Campus and Embark developed out-of action groups at SFPIRG. Action groups are one of the ways that student activists can take action for change. Visit us at www.sfpirg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca. sfpirg.ca to learn more about starting your own action group today.